And good morning. Welcome to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. My name's Paul Rowland, and we once again, after last month's technical problems, have got monthly co-host Jacqueline Keeler in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm not sure your mic is working here.
Is it not working?
I guess it is. Well, I guess we'll find out. So is any of it working? Okay. So here we are, and we're going to talk about her new article that just came out in Yes Magazine. They publish it in full. Why Reading Sherman Alexie Was Never Enough: Tokenism in Publishing Meets the Reality of Epidemic Violence Against Native Women. That's kind of three parts to there, which we'll be exploring. And I just found out at the last minute, we've got Litza Dremusis, the woman in Seattle whose article started this off.
Her tweets. Series, yeah.
And then NPR got in touch with her, and apparently 80 women now have come forward talking about that. You want to introduce Litza?
Sure. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Litza is an amazing writer in Seattle, and she began the public revelations of Sherman Alexie's sexual harassment of other of women, and particularly of Native women writers, on Twitter. Gosh, I think just 9 or 10 days ago. I mean, it's really been quite a week and a half, and really helped garner the NPR coverage of women's allegations, and has really brought this to the forefront.
And she is the author of Altitude Sickness, and of her work has appeared in Esquire, MSN, NPR, New York Magazine, The Rumpus, and elsewhere. And she'll be joining us. I think she might actually be on the phone right now. So you want to kick off this story? This obviously means a lot to you as a Native writer. I don't know if you know personally any of these women who've come forward, but I know you've told me you've been having a lot of conversations, interviews with a lot of people about this. Just a what's going on with this whole thing?
Yeah, I am. Sherman Alexie is a giant in Native literature, I think his own words, he's like a 500-pound gorilla or something, and who sees himself, as sort of outside of Native literature, like more in line with other literary mainstream literary lions, and I was really unaware until this all came forward of his behavior, and I'm sure Litza can tell us more about it, but basically it's pretty terrible. He sexually harassed many women, women who came to him admiring his work, his writing, he basically suppressed the careers, sidelined the careers of particularly Native women writers, writers who are very vulnerable and do not have a lot of access to the publishing industry, and in my article I detail how he threatened them, and so. That was it's pretty shocking stuff.
And I just want to stop you there. Apparently, we do have Litza on the phone. We'll introduce her, bring her in just a second. For some reason, that's stuck with me. One thing you said that you didn't know, which it's not necessarily that unusual. You travel in different circles, but it seems like I would think that among Native writers, it seems a little shocking to me that hadn't come out.
Well, I'm not in the literary world. I'm a nonfiction journalist, writer. My books are,
This had been circulating
amongst Native women who were in the literary world, and so they were kind of like you've heard over the whole Me Too, Time's Up, you know, is that women secretly clue each other in quietly. And so that has been occurring over the last 25 years of his career. And so, but I was unaware of it. And quite frankly, I hadn't really followed his career very closely. And so in writing this article, I spent the last week really learning more about what he'd written and the content of it. And also, you know, watching a lot of his speeches that he'd given and interviews like on with Bill Moyers and Time Magazine and I do quote different pertinent parts of it, and learning more about what he's telling the world about the Native experience, and I was actually very disappointed.
Well, obviously that does show again the power that he obviously had in that world, that this stuff didn't come out publicly before.
Oh yeah, members of the Native literary community were very fearful of coming out, and because he has very powerful friends in the industry, and they still are fearful. Actually, a lot of them won't go on. You know, a lot of what I was told was on background, not all of it, of course, because there are actual quotes in the article. But yeah, it's he had a lot of power, and this really speaks to the marginalization of Native voices in the white publishing industry, where we have this basically a token who they chose to be our spokesman, and then he did act as a gatekeeper in that role.
Well, I'll step aside here. I know we've got Litza on the phone, and I'll, Jacqueline, you can engage with.
Hi, Litza. Are you there?
Good morning, Jacqueline. Hi.
Good morning. How are you doing?
You want to go ahead? I'm doing well. I apologize preemptively that my dog will try and chime in from time to time. So.
Okay. So Litza is calling in from Seattle, where she lives and works. Maybe you could tell us a little about, you know, your role in all this. Sure.
First of all, thank you for asking me to be on. Secondly, your Yes Magazine piece that ran yesterday is brilliant, and as many people are reading it, I recommend it to absolutely everyone who's following this story. When I came forward, it was now 20 days ago, and it seems, I mean, it's still a very, very short period of time. I have known since October, the truncated version because we're on air. A colleague and friend of mine in October, while all women around the world were sharing their Me Too stories online, she shared one. She was not in any way trying to out Sherman. She obliquely referenced characteristics wherein you would have to know him offstage to know it was Sherman. She and I aren't close friends, but we've done readings together, and I adore and trust her. And I privately emailed her and said, is it Sherman? And she said, yes. And then she told me there were a group of women in Seattle. So very quickly, I learned there's a group of women writers in Seattle. To a person, they're all far younger than Alexi. And they're brilliant writers, but they have vastly less clout in the industry than Alexi does. And to emphasize the point each of you has already made, he is a titan in the literary industry, both among Native writers. He's a gatekeeper for Native writers, but in the mainstream white-controlled publishing industry, he is a titan. And they told me they were trying to figure out how to confront him. And I said, well, he and I are close friends. I can email, if you want me to, I can email him right now. And my buddy colleague said, would you? So I waited till morning to distill this into an email, because I'm now trying to process the shock and the horror that one of my closest friends is sexually harming young authors. At this point, I had no idea of the scope, the magnitude, the history that he's been doing it his entire career. And I emailed him in the morning, and as everyone can read in my public statement that I've already given to the stranger and is already online, at no point does he ever reply and say, no, I didn't do it. What are you talking about? Which, if someone had not done it, that would be what they would do. That you would reply and say, what the hell are you talking about? Instead, he immediately removed the contact information for his literary agent, his speaking agent, and his assistant. He immediately removed those from his website. Later that week, he took down his Facebook fan page. 4 days after I confronted him, he canceled his upcoming sold-out season with Seattle Arts and Lectures. He had his own series called Sherman Alexi Loves, which now that title doesn't age well. And then 9 days after I confronted him, he resigned from IAIA.
Which is?
I sever all contact with him in October after this email. I've had no contact with him. No, but I knew at some point I couldn't ethically come public because the women didn't want to go public yet. Once women took to the comment sections at Children's Library Journal, and once David Perry, who's a wonderful journalist at Pacific Standard, found them credible enough to link to in Pacific Standard in the piece he wrote about Daniel Handler's sexual harassment of women, I could ethically then come forward. I came forward on Twitter almost 3 weeks ago. And at this point, I knew, because I'd now started to hear stories from women writers in Los Angeles, I knew there were 20 women for certain when I came forward. To be clear, with the 80 mentioned earlier, 80 women have now contacted me since I started funneling or suggesting women go to NPR. NPR contacted me. I have not contacted a single media outlet. I've now been contacted by 52. NPR is rigorously ethical and has the institutional knowledge and the in-house counsel to do a story of this magnitude properly, which was why, after speaking with Ellen and Lynn at NPR at length, I suggested to the women who wanted to talk, come forward. NPR then interviewed, out of the 80 who approached me, NPR then interviewed 10, three of whom are on the record, four of whom are on the record if you include me. They've got an hour-long interview with me. All of us have been rigorously vetted by their legal department, and we have been fact-checked repeatedly by editorial. So everything that's a matter of record with NPR, it is very much a matter of record. And then Alyssa Washuda, God love her, who was one of the three women who came forward on the record with NPR, did a follow-up segment the next day with KUOW, including still more horrifying details of everything, all the sexual harm she incurred at the hands of Alexei.
Yeah, that was really pretty. I have. She actually contacted me and gave me further details about what happened with him, and I put those in the article as well. And so it's That's about the plagiarism accusations.
Jacqueline, you and I both know this. No one is enjoying this story. It's horrifying. It's saddening. People who looked up to him from afar, I've read their tweets and comments saying they're crying. I was close friends with him. It is devastating to learn someone you trusted so implicitly was actively harming this many people over what now looks like, as you uncovered, throughout most of his career. When I came forward on Twitter, what I thought would happen, I knew the affair would come out. It's a matter of, you know, it's already a matter of public record right now. I told all my friends and family, I said, I'm going to get hit really hard, but he can't really do anything to me. My career is established. I can take the hit. It's fine. I don't care. I'm 51, whatever. Even when I came forward, I had no inkling he was disproportionately targeting Native women throughout his career and then actively silencing them and then saying, if you tell, I will see to it you never publish again, or that he was bullying them. In my wildest dreams, when I came forward 20 days ago, as much as I knew about Alexei and how deeply awful it was, I still could not have guessed he was actively silencing Native voices. And to the degree that I've had a chance to process any of this, which I don't think any of us have, that's monstrous to a level I almost can't comprehend.
Yeah, I think.
And as Jacqueline, as you've rightly pointed out, a huge problem within the publishing industry, which is still largely run by whites, he was anointed the gatekeeper. Alyssa should never have had to go to Sherman for a blurb. As Alyssa and I have talked, we knew each other before all this. I'm Greek. There's not a publisher in the world who cares if you've got 12 Greek authors. Because I'm white, I'm 100% Greek, but because I'm white, it's essentially a meritocracy for me. I haven't had to put myself in harm's way to get a blurb, to get an introduction. The fact that Alyssa's own publisher was actively encouraging her get a blurb from Alexei Well, what does that tell you? The man has an enormous amount of power to make and break careers, and that was some of that isn't his fault. It's not his fault the white-controlled publishing industry anointed him. What is definitely 100% his fault is he didn't use that power for good. He used it to harm other Native voices.
Yeah, and Alyssa is a young Native writer, and she
brilliant.
Yes,
she's so talented,
and she actually was asked to for her first book, which was actually about
My Body is a Book of Rules.
Yes, My Body is a Book of Rules. You know, it was actually about sexual assault and all of that. And then in a group, she trying to get this blurb, she actually went out one evening with him and some other folks in Seattle, and he told them all loudly that he could F her if he wanted to.
And again, going to just how much Alexei knows exactly what he's doing, I was at that event. He first started preying on Alyssa roughly 10 to 15 minutes after I left. I was hanging out laughing with him and some other mutual friends, and we were all hanging out, perfectly normal writer evening. I leave, boom, he goes for Alyssa. He knows exactly what he's doing. This is not accidental. He knows exactly what he's doing.
And then later, she ended up working with him. They were colleagues at II, the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which began an MFA program for Native writers, which Alexei was very instrumental in. And while they were there, he began to sexually harass her again, inviting her to his hotel room. And then also, then later, when she didn't respond, accused her of plagiarism, and basically made her feel, she basically felt at that point she had to leave the institution. And she told NPR that, she says, and I'm sure they continue to do really good work there, but I'm not a part of it, and that feels so lonely. I'm incredibly sad about it. He basically drove her out of a program that helps bring other Native writers to the fore.
He did. And he, as you referenced in Alyssa's book, her first book, My Body is a Book of Rules, and her second book, Starvation Mode, is equally wonderful. But in her first book, she writes at length about being a sexual assault survivor. That's another pattern that emerged as I was coordinating with NPR. And I've done all of this for free because I wanted to do it for free. I didn't want to take a paycheck for it. I'm in the contributor network at The Washington Post. I can't ethically cover anyone I know. I'm contractually forbidden from covering anyone I know with The Washington Post. But in Alyssa's book, she writes at length that she's a sexual assault survivor. One of the patterns that emerged as more and more women came forward to NPR is how many women are sexual assault survivors and in how many instances Alexei knew they were sexual assault survivors.
Yeah, and this becomes, one of the things that really comes out in a lot of the reporting is that for Native women who have the highest rates of sexual assault in the country, bar none, I mean, 2.5 times the rate of rape, and in some counties, 9 times the rate of murder. And these are Department of Justice statistics. And
these are government statistics.
Yeah, and it's definitely Native women have a much higher rate of sexual assault than other women of any other ethnic group in this country. And so targeting women, having someone be the primary spokesperson for Native people who is himself a predator, right, is incredibly problematic. And certainly, shows that we can't have tokenism. We can't have one person speak for all of us.
Exactly.
And it's especially, one of the things I bring up is the fact that basically he made, I think you're right in here, and threatening the career prospects of Native women writers, Alexei made subjugation the bar Native women would have to clear to be heard.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm just going to step in and ask the, the article you just published with Yes Magazine, Jacqueline, is Why Reading Sherman Alexei Was Never Enough, Tokenism in Publishing Meets the Reality of Epidemic Violence Against Native Women, which is, again, like three parts. So this tokenism in publishing. So talk about how you think he acquired such status in the literary world.
Well, it's interesting because when I went through a lot of his interviews, he talks, you know, he kind of brags a lot about being the only one, right? And he actually, in his interview with, I think with the Big Think, which, you know, they do a series of videos online, and he basically talks about how, you know, there, when he first started out in publishing, there were like 30, you know, well-known Native writers coming from the 70s and 80s. And now, you know, when he, after he came out in 1992 or something, basically now there's only him, you know.
And he's asked why, and he says, I don't know.
Yeah, he says that all he's like, he actually puts the, he actually says that the, what, the publishing world is not racist. He dismisses that outright and says the problem.
That's in the Time magazine interview. Yeah.
Oh, that's, oh, yeah, the Time. Yeah. And basically he says they're not racist. And the problem is that they're just not, he doesn't know why Native writers are not submitting anything because, you know, the agents and publishers out there would just love, editors would love to get a novel, a manuscript like his, or like Louise Erdrich, who is a very well-known Ojibwe writer and also a National Book Award winner like Alexei. And I was just like, you know, I actually know Louise Erdrich pretty well. You know, I went to Dartmouth and she used to kind of, she actually actively mentored young Native women, you know, and I'd heard from her when I was an undergraduate that, you know, none of the publishers would take her book. I mean, she submitted it everywhere, Love Medicine, her first book. And she basically, her husband, who Michael Doris was a well-known writer, he posed as her literary agent and submitted the books as her fake literary agent. And that's how she got her first book deal. They were not dancing. He says they would dance if they got a really great book like that. That's not what happened. And it's even worse now. I mean, the publishing industry is, you know, far more, it's under a lot of financial duress with the new media, social media and online media. And it's even more difficult to be heard. And so I had a quote in there from a publisher's saying, editor saying that, you know, basically they have like 60 seconds to devote to looking at something on the slush pile, the manuscripts that just show up at their, on their desk. And if they will give an extra 30 seconds if a friend, someone tells them to look at it. And that 30 seconds can make or break a person's career. And Native people don't have that kind of access. The white publishing industry is 80% white women, right? And then if you go up to the executive level, it's 50% white men. Right. And it is really, really not very representative. And I did a breakdown of the young adult publishing industry. And what I found was that for Black and Native writers, about 1,000 books a year, which if it were done equitably, right, by population, would go to Black and Native writers. And those books go to white writers. And so those are all opportunities to be heard, which are not, you know, there is no real embrace for Native writers. They're not getting even a fair deal.
Not even close.
And let me just remind people, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Rowland, and my once-a-month co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, is in the studio with me, who just wrote an article for Yes Magazine about the I guess you call it Me Too. The Me Too spotlight has moved to Indian country, focusing on Sherman Alexie and his behavior over apparently decades. And I'm sure people are familiar with Sherman Alexie. He is such a famous writer. I read several Sherman Alexie books and enjoyed at least the first couple. Anyway, we also have on the phone from Seattle, Litza Jermesis. Actually, how do you pronounce your last name?
It's Litza Jermusis, but I'll answer to anything even close.
I hurriedly scribbled it down. My apologies.
Don't even worry. Litza Jermusis.
Okay, and she, her tweet, now 20 days ago, got the
boy. A series of tweets
attracted the attention of the media and focused attention, and then it all came out, most notably on NPR. Who has been following this story. So with that up to date, we are also a talk show, a call-in show, and the number to call in to join the conversation is 503-231-8187. This is a very unique opportunity you have to engage these two remarkable women about this subject. I just want to let you know that there's been a change in Political Perspectives, which is coming up at 9 after this. Maru Mora will discuss the struggles of people facing deportation. Andrea Williams of Causa, Oregon was going to be on but will not be on. And Linda will take your calls. That's at 9 on Political Perspectives. Linda Olson Osterlin will have Maru Mora on to talk about the struggles of people facing deportation. I might as well tell you what else is coming up. At 10, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, as always, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And 11, the dirt bag is pruning peaches and planting peas, plus your gardening questions. Portland area weather today, chance of showers with thunderstorms possible after noon, mostly cloudy with a high near 54. Guess I didn't have to read that. Anyway, thank all our KBOO members for your generous support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kbo.fm and click on donate to become a member. And I'm back with Jacqueline Keeler. So we're talking about tokenism. You know, it's just so the whole issue of him, I think as we put it before the show, that taking up so much oxygen and sort of not allowing just by virtue of his presence and his being kind of, it's like a star system, his being the native writer. So everybody, it's like the big blockbuster films. Everybody, you know, he's a guaranteed, you know, good seller, if not bestseller. So why not stick with a sure horse? And so that's one thing. But then that you know, there's these young Native women writers actually, you know, go to him for blurbs. But some of them actually apparently were actually interested in, you know, some really young people just getting started, maybe not even having been published, looking to him as a sort of as a mentor figure, and him using that power is just horrible.
Yeah, I think I know that. I think it's it really one of the things I open my piece up with is the idea that you know that we have to rearrange the furniture of our collective sort of living rooms. You know, we have this cultural furniture that we've used to sort of be signifiers and to understand and comprehend our world. Like we our concepts about, you know, New York City are really shaped by, you know, Woody Allen's work. You know, we have a whole generation of Oscar winners that came out of, you know, Weinstein's films. And now knowing what those women went through, you know, at his hands. And now we have to completely alter the way we look at the world, and we have to find new cultural furniture. And part of it is that we've been denied things. All the writers, all the women who could have written things, you know, and didn't, because and I talk a lot about the power of yes. And
why don't you just read that? What you just said was in your first paragraph, and you know, you are a writer and a very good one, I might say. And so it's always nice to hear. You're actually the flow of your writing.
Okay. So I say, we are people of stories, communicating over digital displays via words and memes, repackaging ideas in 2-minute videos, captioned so we can grasp them even with the sound turned off. Even before that, American identity was the product of propaganda called Manifest Destiny. And before that, we had origin stories to define the national identities of a multitude of indigenous peoples. And as keepers of stories, we must from time to time purge some of our cultural furniture, or at least move it around. After Me Too, we can honestly say we live in an altered world. The hidden monstrous natures of the men who some of our most prized cultural furniture have been made plain. And the world they built for us is different now. The furniture they have filled our mental rooms with, films, books, characters, ideas, songs, political movements, poems, we were told defined us, or at least delineated the world of possibility.
And again, that's from Jacqueline's new article, Why Reading Sherman Alexie Was Never Enough, Tokenism in Publishing Meets the Reality of Epidemic Violence Against Native Women. That's in Yes Magazine, and there's a link to it from the program page for Wednesday Talk Radio. At go to our website, kboo.fm, for that and many other excellent, well, I'm not saying this is excellent, but many excellent programs. Anyway, before we get back to Litza, we really appreciate you having on. Just to get into this, why reading Sherman Alexie Was Never Enough, that's a provocative statement.
Yeah. Well, as I began to interview members, I did a lot of interviews on background with members of the Native American literary world, Native American professors and writers. And they really, I had not really followed Sherman's career, to be honest, to a really very comprehensive extent. Like, I hadn't really read a lot of his work. And so it was really shocking to me to hear more, and particularly to hear about his behavior at lectures. Over the years, I probably have only heard him speak three times, and I personally just enjoyed them. But as I talk to more and more Native folks, as I say in the article, from Harvard to Nunavut is an incredibly remote Native community in northern Canada, and that I heard many people, you know, talk about how they were really unhappy with what they heard him say. They felt like he promoted stereotypes in his work that caused white people to laugh at us rather than with us. And that there was some of the critiques I heard about Diary of his book, Diary of a Part-Time Indian, for which he won the National Book Award in the Young Adult section, was that, you know, in a lot of it, he seems to promote this idea that, you know, that white people were more that his ability to fit in with the white world is what made him successful. And
indeed, that's true.
Yeah. Getting a white girlfriend, succeeding at a white high school as a basketball player. And the book actually ends with them defeating the Indian team, you know, and people a lot of Native people didn't feel good about that. And then other issues with his depiction of flight, of particularly the Battle of Bighorn. A lot of Lakota people were very upset about it. It was considered very disrespectful. So I quoted a really great essay I really recommend people read it, called Laughing Indian, which is from a trans Navajo Diné writer and futurist, Luke Warnham. He writes, despite cycling and recycling the same old tropes told in the same voice, a Sherman Alexie book has received not one poor review. Is Alexie really such a flawless writer that critics cannot go beyond praise as repetitive as his oeuvre itself? Or are most reviewers seduced by the charming prose of an Indian who eases their guilty consciences? The latter seems much more likely. For both Vine Deloria and Alexie, humor is about survival. The difference, however, is that Deloria sees survival in asserting tribal Indian identity. Alexie sees it at a chuckling distance. So there's this notion that he's sort of making our pain palatable to white readers and allowing them to sort of laugh at us. And so, you know, I heard this repeatedly, and I did look at some of the pieces, and you know, even I was actually, you know, I had read some of his short stories and poetry and enjoyed it, but I was never able to finish any of his novels, to be honest. And I'm a writer myself, and when the whole thing, they were trying to ban his book, Diary of a Part-Time Indian, or Diary of a, yeah, part-time. My mom, like, got, you know, all up in arms, and she bought copies of it for all her grandchildren. This must have been 2008 or so. And my children were very small at the time, but I went ahead and tried to read the book to them anyway. I'm the kind of person who reads entire books to my kids at night before they go to bed. And so I tried to read it to them. And then I got to the part where he was discussing how their family was too poor to be able to afford a vet. And so they basically just killed their pet, right? And I was uncomfortable reading that to my children because as Native people, we face a lot of negative stereotypes and we're told a lot of negative things about ourselves. And when I went to school, and actually it's funny, I was actually featured in a New York Times piece at Thanksgiving, this past Thanksgiving, and my writing and Sherman's writing about Thanksgiving. And in that piece, I talk about how my mom told me when I went to school, she says, don't listen to what those teachers tell you about Indians. They're going to tell you we're drunks, we're this and we're that. I'm going to teach you what, you know, our history. I'm going to teach you who we are. You know, don't listen to them. And so that gave me permission to assert an identity that was constructive and healthy for myself as a young child. And I looked at this and I was like, yes, there are a lot of poor people in this country that can't afford veterinary care for their pets. That's true, you know, and I'm sure that was possibly true for his own family. But that is not true for all Indian people. I mean, my grandparents ran a ranch right near the south rim of the Grand Canyon, thousands of acres, and You know, they their animals were their livelihood. They would call the vet, you know. So it is not, this is not really, I mean, this is one perspective, but it's not the only perspective. And that is the problem with having a token, you know, having a singular voice speak for all of us. His experience is not universal. And also there was this whole issue with librarians, you know, that he was telling people that they had to, if a Native writer did not include alcoholism in their family, in their books, that they were, you know, kind of fronting, you know. And he told them that, and actually librarians were telling each other not to purchase books from Native writers who did not have alcoholism in their books.
So that's Jacqueline Keeler speaking. And we also have Litsa Dramusis on the line from Seattle, who had a long-term, I don't know how long-term, but it was close to Sherman Lexie. Apparently he seems to have broken off with her now.
To be clear, I broke off the friendship and I broke off the affair for that matter. But continue. I'm with you.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. There are a lot of key people to keep straight. I completely understand.
Okay.
Don't worry.
So it seems a little uncomfortable talking about all this sort of with you a little bit. That's just me probably. But I don't know. The question that I guess immediately springs to mind is, is this sort of making you look back and sort of rethink a lot of things? I assume it is. Is there anything you want to share with us about that?
Definitely. Definitely. And that's an extremely insightful question. For starters, and Jacqueline knows this, I was a domestic violence victim advocate for roughly 2 years in the early 1990s. I volunteered at the King County Crisis Clinic. I volunteered with Northwest Women's Law Center, which is now Legal Voices. So part of, because NPR asked me on the record in my interview that has been vetted legally and editorially, it didn't run, but we kept me for background. Why did I automatically believe the women as opposed to my friend of 15 years? Well, A, we know people who incur sexual harm almost never lie about it when they come forward. Secondly, the details the women presented were so specific to Alexie that if you knew Alexie offstage, it was clearly Alexie. What I've had to rethink, and you're hearing this a lot in Seattle, there were a group of us to whom he was very good. He was nothing but encouraging to me as an author. And most of the time, we rarely discussed writing. We emailed each other all the time. And as everyone knows by now, he is a compulsive emailer, which was in part what did him in, because the women he harassed saved all the emails, all the photos he sent, saved letters he sent. But most of what we would talk about was our families. As Jacqueline has written about brilliantly for the Daily Dot, the overlaps between Greek culture and Native culture, we both have these large, boisterous families in, and I'm not trying to lump all Native tribes in together by any means, but our sense of family is not a nuclear family. It's your aunts, your uncles, your cousins, you know, it's everyone. And we'd send each other photos of our dogs. It was a very normal friendship, which I find more disturbing in many ways, because again, going back to a point I made earlier, he knows exactly what he's doing, that he preyed upon Alyssa within 10 to 15 minutes after I departed for the evening, demonstrates how clearly he knows what he's doing. And Paul, I appreciate that you're being incredibly delicate regarding my own personal life. At this point, it's all out there. I'm comfortable answering anything. NPR asked me that from the beginning when they were vetting me. Was he in any way violent or coercive privately? No. I have been alone with him when I first got to know him, and I interviewed him for Movie Maker magazine in 2001 and later interviewed him for The Believer in 2006. The Believer found his answers too controversial and killed the interview, and then later had Nico Case interview him in 2008. I've been alone with him in personal settings. He was nothing but kind, funny, gentle. I had no idea. My mother is a retired deputy prosecuting attorney. My father is the retired supervisor of the sentencing unit from King County. I grew up listening to crime stories at the dinner table. And my father grew up under Nazi occupation in Greece and then the subsequent Greek
Civil War. So I've heard a lot of horrific stories my entire life, or I've encountered them in my work as a domestic violence victim advocate. I want to be clear, Sherman does not rise to the level of Nazism in any way, but among stories of sexual misconduct that I encountered in my work or heard about from my parents' work, this stands out in that this is someone who was so powerful, who at every step of the way knew exactly what he was doing. And what we're finding in Seattle now, and this is characteristic of predators, there were a number of us to whom he was very good. And Jacqueline, I've forgotten the name of the author and essayist who wrote about her father's time in San Quentin, because she addressed that in her own essay. When women would compare notes, there was a sense of cognitive dissonance, because some of us he was incredibly good to. And then there were women who he was just awful in the deepest moral sense of that word, which meant he can turn it on and off. This isn't an accident. The second part to this story that has largely gone unreported, because it is still a short matter of time since all of this has happened, is there are a lot of people who never saw this side of him. And what I thought would happen when I came forward 20 days ago, I assumed wrongly that people like me who are middle-aged with established careers whom he could not touch. I assumed everyone who at this point knew, because I know for a fact there are others like me who know, and some of them are in Seattle, I thought they'd chime in. I did not anticipate the protracted silence of other people who know. And that is also disturbing, and I haven't had time to process that. But Paul, going back to your original question, yes, it's called into question a huge chunk of my adult life. If this were 2 years ago and someone had told me that Sherman Alexie was repeatedly sexually harming women throughout his career and disproportionately targeting young Native women writers, I would have heard it with the same degree of absurdity all of us still feel that Donald Trump is president. There would have been a profound sense of shock, disbelief. No, you've got to be kidding. That can't be right. You're lying. 2 years ago, I would have trusted the man with my life, and I had no reason not to, but it's now causing me to reexamine everything. The one time he lashed out at me, the one time he ever lashed out at me via email, I wrongfully attributed it to the grief. You know, in addition to losing Lillian, his mom, and we were so close when Lillian died, he was emailing me all day, every day, and that's what you do when your friend, you're there for your friend when their mom dies. But he lost and his mom and had brain surgery in less than 2 years. The one time he lashed out at me via email, I made a joke. He said something profoundly stupid. And I teased him and I said, Sherman, he thought my friend had a crush on him, and no, she doesn't, and she's happily married. And he said, does she know I'm an adulterous husband? And I wrote back and I said, Sherman, emails like this are why women get to live longer than men. I said, no, it's a mutual friend of ours. I said, no, she doesn't have a crush on you. He just kept bombarding me with the most furious emails ever. And we'd always teased each other, so I didn't know this was going to set off this firestorm. I apologized for hurting him. I said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hurt you. He still kept lashing out. I let him just run his course, and 2 weeks later said, you can never treat me like that again. You can never, ever talk to me like that again. What now is clear is that I was seeing a side of him that what I was attributing to brain surgery and losing four people close to him in the period of 2 years, which is understandable when people are grieving, they do sometimes lash out irrationally. When I lost my partner of 21 years, I was not always in a great mood. I had finally seen the side of him that countless women had seen over decades. And I want to give Jacqueline credit when, like, to be clear, I coordinated or aligned with NPR because they contacted me and they're rigorously ethical and they are among the best in the business. I did it all for free. I'm not taking a check for this. With women coming forward to NPR and to me, we had women going back to 1998 Jacqueline has had women come forward dating back to 1994. Given that Alexius first published in 92, it's safe to assume this. It's definitely, we now know factually with 100% certainty, it's the majority of his career. There's no reason to think there was any point in his career at which he wasn't at least bullying women.
Yeah,
and I don't, as a domestic violence victim advocate who was trained to spot this behavior, and I have successfully spotted it in other parts of my life, he fooled me too.
Well, that's, yeah, I think the case you're bringing up is when I began interviewing members of the Native literary community, they kept bringing up the story of Tiffany Midge.
Right.
And so I interviewed her and a lot of it was on the record because it was an interview he gave and that was actually in the Studies in American Indian Literatures and basically he accused her of being a second rate copy of him and this was very devastating to her. And after she won a award for her book of poetry. This was in the mid-90s. He came up to her after she won the award and told her that her book would never sell because she had poems in there that were deriding John Wayne and that white people wouldn't like it. And he had wanted someone else to win the award. And she said she went home and cried. And I was, you know, and I just, she later gave me this statement. And she, you know, she gave me a long written statement with, you know, all kinds of screen caps and evidence of, and she said, it is not a comfort by any means to know I am not alone in my experiences. Several people are alluding to similar treatment, whose worst treatment and abuses, in fact, in regards with Alexi. Yet to know that I have not been alone is, in fact, a kind of validation and a necessary balm to my own self-incriminating interior script. Maybe I was defeated and undermined all those years ago. Maybe his bullying did, in fact, negatively impact my trajectory and potential success. I know I've spent years playing those encounters and others through my head. Endlessly, I always blamed myself for the abuse and transgressions. I wasn't smart enough or talented or cool enough. I must have deserved to be mocked and maligned. I've made a million excuses. And she is a Lakota writer from Standing Rock. And you know, they're contemporary. She's a few years younger than him, but you know, he actively, I say, like I've been describing, sort of doing a Tonya Harding, you know, using his access to the publishing world to sort of undermine other Native writers who don't have that access, and you can see that I have a whole section called The Power of Yes and how we often need permission to write, you know, and that, you know, he got that permission. He talks about, actually in his interview, about how he was an active alcoholic at the time, and it was going out to the mailbox and finding that his book of poetry had been accepted that got him to quit drinking. And sometimes, you know, we really need to be told that we have the right to write and also that we have, that there's a potential for success. And he actively denied that to other writers, particularly Native women. And we'll never know what books might have been written.
And he doesn't even flinch. If I mean, we've watched all the same interviews when he's discussing this, when he's asked in a number of interviews, you know, why do you think there aren't more Native writers? He doesn't even flinch when he gives the answer. And he knows why.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, the other writers that he talks about from the 1970s, people like Pulitzer Prize winner N. Scott Mamede and, you know, of course, Leslie Marmon Silka, who's a brilliant Pueblo writer,
right.
You know, you know, Linda Hogan and all these writers, you know, they actively work to try to share their access with other younger Native writers. And you know, and until actually he started mentoring students at the Institute of American Indian Arts at IAI in Santa Fe, he did not. And it's really quite remarkable. I note, like, you know, his gushing introduction to Canadian memoirist, First Nations Canadian memoirist, Teresa Mailhot. I don't know how to pronounce her name. But she, and now she got, you know, garnered her New York Times reviews for her book. You know, she was just on The Daily Show last week. And they didn't ask her, you know, Trevor Noah did not ask her about her mentor, you know, and basically, you know, she got the golden ticket and when it was redeemable and, you know, and it shows what he could have been doing for other Native writers all these years. You know, and it's also rather disturbing that her book is also about, you know, dealing with sexual assault. And, you know, she had actually spent time, well, they both spent time in mental institutions while they were in their mentee-mentor relationship. And so it's, it is rather, and it is disturbing that this would be our singular voice. Like, is she going to now be the white publishing industry's only voice for Native people? And she's not even Native American. She's Canadian, you know, but they can't tell the difference. You know, it's.
And like Jacqueline, as you had told me, of course, as you've already made clear, you are a graduate from Dartmouth. Your aunt, if I remember correctly, she's a professor at Columbia.
No, my great aunt was, she was an ethnologist. She worked with Columbia University, documenting Dakota, Lakota, Nakota culture and stories and language. And, but you know, the, yeah, I mean, there are political differences, and I'm going to write another essay dealing with the sovereignty aspect, which I think that Alexei did not have a clear grasp on.
Yeah. I was going to actually ask you what sort of politics, but you said you haven't engaged that thoroughly probably with his works enough to, but I, you know, the books that I read, this has been quite a number of years. I felt there was something that I was very uneasy. It seemed like there was a sort of an apolitical, a studied apoliticalness. You know, he's sort of come out on, I think he came out on this, you know, Standing Rock, the DAPL issue and stuff, you know, made some public statements, but I didn't feel like there was a really conscious, well, sort of indigenous.
It's interesting. I talked to folks, you know, who had attended his lectures, and they told me that when he spoke at Harvard last year, he actively sneered at Standing Rock and he called Lakota people the F in Lakota, and they felt that it was really disrespectful, and you know, I and it was interesting too that a lot of the Native women that he maligned were Lakota women. He actually went after a relative of mine, Elizabeth Cook Lynn, who is a very well known and respected Dakota scholar and writer. She wrote Why I Hate Wallace Stegner and other essays. And he went after her, you know, I mean, because of her stance on sovereignty. And he was actively apolitical. That's definitely true. And I think he misunderstands what sovereignty means. And actually, it's interesting in his book, Flight, people really referred to it a lot because he has this terrible section about the Battle of the Bighorn in which he talks about the Lakota being smelly and there being like, it was just really horrible and really offended. I mean, literally, I had 12 Lakota people come up to me and say, this really offended me. And he seems to have an active sort of hatred of Lakota people. And and then also the end of the book, apparently the people feel like there's an anti-Muslim aspect to it. And where the family that adopts the boy actually is Muslim, and then he thinks they're nice, and it turns out they are terrorists.
Well, we only have 5 minutes left, 4 minutes left, and this is obviously a conversation. We're not going to do justice to the subject in an hour. I don't know. It seems kind of a trite question, I guess, but you know, the feeling I've gotten, you know, with these series of revelations about powerful men abusing their power, I guess no surprise to you all. But I keep waiting for someone to like sort of break, you know, not just apologize, but like to actually, you know, engage in serious self-reflection and actually use it, you know, to become a better person, to actually, you know, become an advocate, to like take it to use it to take a step further instead of retrenching. Or it sounds like the portrait you're painting, you know, obviously Lizette have a different view of him, having been close to him and seeing another side. I mean, do you see that side of him possibly learning something, you know, because some of these men have got to, you know, take this in a different direction?
I want to answer quickly, so Jacqueline deservedly gets the last word. First of all, I've been moved by how many women and some very good men saw that Alexei's apology is not an apology. Huge chunks of it are false and defamatory, and I'm using that in the clearest legal terms.
And it was very much not only an attempt to silence me, it was an attempt to silence all the other women from coming forward. I would hope, in my fondest hope, of course, I'm an optimist at heart. I would like to think in time he learns from this and he is genuinely contrite. We have no evidence of that so far. His false and defamatory statement about me right now is on the homepage of his website under his own name and under the name of his LLC. That's not contrition and that's not self-reflection and it's certainly not taking responsibility. Quickly regarding Standing Rock, because he and I were friends, what now seems clear is most likely another lie. I am disabled, and I don't say this in a self-congratulatory way, but I did attend Seattle Stands with Standing Rock downtown. I have marched with Black Lives Matter. He knew this, and at every step of the way, you know, he does have a bad back. That is true, that he has a bad back. But people asked him why he wasn't going to Standing Rock, and he didn't go to his own induction into the American Academy of Arts and Letters because his back was so bad at the time. I now look back, Paul, going back to your earlier question on things that I am now reevaluating. Yes, his back was too bad to travel to Standing Rock. Why wasn't he downtown with the rest of us? He and I lived close to each other at the time. It's a 10-minute drive downtown. For Seattle Stands with Standing Rock, I'm inclined to think, and this is just what I'm surmising, I'm inclined to think, given the number of Native women in particular, who knew the truth about him, he was not going to wade into a huge crowd of Natives. I hate to say this, but unless he was getting a check for it. And that's heartbreaking. I mean, that just kind of breaks my heart.
Well, we actually have to wrap up.
I'm gonna wrap up. Jacqueline gets the last word. This is hers.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I would just say that just given the huge the amount of stories, this is a systemic problem, and I'm not sure if if he's capable, like she said, of change. And yeah, I think that we definitely. Like I said, I think we need to focus on the women who have stories to tell as well, their writing and their books.
Okay, that will be the last word. Thank you both so much. This has been really, really, really good program. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is Paul Rowland, Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned.